there's a million ways to add value to an RV park, whereas there's probably only a half dozen ways to add value to an apartment building or a shopping center or what have you.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Matt Whittermore is an active investor in apartments, RV parks, and campgrounds. Originally from the suburbs of Boston, Massachusetts, Matt now resides in Albany, New York. He holds a bachelor's degree in project management from Wentworth Institute of Technology and is an actively licensed real estate salesperson in New York. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Sam. Happy to be here.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. Same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Where did you start? Where are you now? And, you know, briefly, how did you get there?
Sure. I started in real estate, getting my license actually in the state of Massachusetts, doing apartment rentals while I was still a full-time college student. And that quickly evolved into an entry-level full-time position for a small real estate investment company that bought small multifamily properties all around greater Boston. So I worked for them for about 4 years and learned everything to do with real estate, buying properties, selling properties, analyzing them, financing them, and got a taste for some of the bigger deals. Quickly transitioned my career into commercial mortgages, more in the middle market and institutional space. So got to work on all different kinds of real estate, office, retail, industrial, mobile home parks, apartments, obviously, really everything under the sun. And actually worked for a boutique student housing finance and investment sales company. And got to work on some really big deals there, one that was $230 million. So that was super interesting. And the idea was always to get into it for myself, investing, that is. So after about a decade as an employee, I decided to jump into investing myself full-time, bought some small apartment building, and just recently purchased my first commercial property, which is a campground and RV park in the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I love the progression, you know, of your experiences there. You know, with always the eye towards doing it on your own, what were some of the things that maybe, you know, kept you from jumping in sooner?
I think I took, you know, kind of the education piece of it maybe a little too heavily. I know that's a big thing for people. You know, I spend a lot of time on the Bigger Pockets website and things like that and interact with a lot of people that are in the education phase. And, you know, it's also kind of financial considerations of saving up enough money to jump in and getting the personal life in a place that's right to take that risk. So it's a combination of those two things.
Right, right. No, I think that's great. I mean, you know, I don't, you're not going to make, you'll make fewer mistakes being more prepared, certainly, than the idiots like me that just go out and try to figure it out on the fly. So, you know, that's really intriguing. So you stepped out, you learned, you know, really the entirety of the market, it sounds like, you know, from basically every asset class, and you got to see how they were financed, how they were structured, how they were operated, which is really cool. You said you bought some small multifamilies first?
Yes, sir. Yep.
What were those? And can you kind of walk us through that process? And then I want to hear, you know, how that then transitioned into feeling like you had the experience and the understanding to buy an RV park and campground.
Good question. So, you know, I'm a numbers guy, and I like statistics and probability. So whenever I'm in any sort of sales or production type role, I'm all about casting a wide net and setting myself up for success. So that's really the simplistic reason that I started with the small apartment buildings, because there's just so many of these assets in every town around you. So I built up a list of a few thousand properties that I was targeting, did direct mail, and you know, they're smaller investments. They're kind of bite-sized. And, you know, it's a risk in investments. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. It's not small multifamily is not what gets me out of bed in the morning, but it was means to an end to start building a portfolio. And I talk about risk with people, with investors and colleagues a lot. And I try to talk people out of, you know, maybe buying a two family as their first investment, because it's more binary vacancy risk. And as a first investment, you buy a two unit and you get one bad tenant, that's going to put a bad taste in your mouth, right? And you might not ever buy another property. So it was, like I said, a means to an end to start building up that real estate owned schedule, that portfolio, look more legitimate to banks when I'm going out to get loans. And so I don't really plan on buying more apartment buildings, especially in the city of Albany, where I own a few of them. And that's also a kind of a municipal kind of climate thing where they're passing all kinds of laws that are not in favor of landlords at all. So, you know, I did fine with it. I have some good properties. I'm actually starting to sell off some of them. And right now the focus is largely campgrounds and RV parks.
Walk us through your thinking on that process. How did you go from small apartment buildings to, I know, RV parks and campgrounds?
A lot of it had to do with COVID, just because of the effects on the multifamily market. The eviction moratorium just totally changes everybody's risk profile on apartments. And, you know, we did all right with it. We didn't really get hammered by any bad situations. We have mostly young professional tenants. So, you know, there were a few bad cases, but it was certainly eye-opening. And really, we had started looking at RV parks and campgrounds prior to COVID, and it was really unintentional to start. This is probably 2 years ago. We built a list of mobile home parks through our software for prospecting and getting owner information and contact info. And a small percentage of our list of mobile home parks was actually miscategorized, and they were RV parks and campgrounds. So we blasted out a bunch of emails and calls, and people started getting back to us and saying, "Hey, Matt, this is not a mobile home park, but yes, I'm interested in selling." So we actually got the chance to tour and meet some almost institutional level RV park owners, which was just, we didn't get to buy the property, but it was so educational to get a look behind the curtain, so to speak, with some really high level owners that have some impressive properties and operations. And we got to see the books and ask a bunch of questions. And essentially, you know, my partner and I just said, "Holy crap, the cash flow is insane on these properties. The fundamentals are phenomenal in the industry. Camping has been, and RVing has been strong for decades, 3-4 decades as a great type of real estate investment. Granted, there's an operating business component, but, and then COVID comes along and we weren't sure what to expect, but we quickly saw that it only increased and enhanced the fundamentals with just unprecedented demand for those campsites. I think there was over 550,000 RVs sold in 2021 already, I believe is the number. Yes. And I just can't even wrap my head around that. You know, there's so many RVs out there with no place to go.
Yeah, you hit that on the head, man. There's going to be some ancillary opportunities, and I'm going to use the word space, you know, that in that asset class, maybe that's more accurate way to put it, that, you know, I think are going to become part of that. Not just the service industries, not just the, you know, I'm also an RV owner, and, you know, finding a mechanic on the road's impossible. Like if you have a problem, so you're going to see mechanic, you know, mobile mechanics for RVs, you know, that's going to pop up, but then also storage for boat and RV storage, that also is going to increase. And also, you know, to your point, RV parks and campgrounds. I mean, they've got to have somewhere to go. So
absolutely.
That's really interesting. Talk to me about the things that you said you got an institutional look kind of behind the curtains, you know, with some of these really, you know, bigger players. What were some of the things that came out of those, you know, interactions that you said, "Ah, I didn't think about that," or "Wow, that's kind of an aha moment for you"?
Sure. And, you know, I think it started with the quality of the property, because similar with mobile home parks and RV parks and campgrounds, people that aren't campers or RVers themselves, they hear trailer park. And it's so funny. I have that conversation all the time. They're like, "Oh, so you're buying like trailer parks? Like, aren't people not paying rent? Don't you have to evict people?" And I'm like, "No, this is a hotel without walls, essentially." And that's the way we look at it. And, you know, it was the biggest benefit of seeing some of these really high-end properties was essentially getting a look at the template of where you could take some of these value add properties. And that's what we focus on, is, you know, properties that are need some help. So it was essentially just getting a cheat sheet of, you know, this is where we could take this property, and it's phenomenal. It's probably a lower cap rate. I'd say those institutional properties they're definitely, the cap rates are compressing, but I think you should still be able to get like maybe an 8% cap rate on those super high end kind of REIT level properties, unless it's in like a super high end destination, then you might be talking like a 5 or 6% cap rate. But we're focused on the 10% plus cap rate space, value add. And that's the beauty of these properties, really, is you can bring so much creativity into it. There's a million ways to add value to an RV park, whereas there's probably only a half dozen ways to add value to an apartment building or a shopping center or what have you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are some of the value add strategies in an RV park?
It's really an endless list. So first off, I think the easiest way is either implement or enhance a website and get online booking. Mm-hmm. So we're a month, 5 weeks into owning this campground RV park. The first thing we did was implement an online booking system, and it just blew up because people are just scouring the internet right now for campsites, right, and just giving them an automated way to book it. We were 100% capacity over this weekend, and we have some campers there that have been there for 8, 14, 16 years. And they told me they had never seen it that busy, and that involved absolutely zero advertising.
Wow. Yeah, that's a key strategy. Yeah, I'm trying to think of times when we've been on the road. Like, if I can't book it online, I'm not monkeying with it. Like, mm-hmm. it's also gonna tell you that that there's loads of deferred maintenance, and like, if you don't have the time to put up a website and a way for me to pay you, like, that means you're also probably, sure, you know, not keeping the water lines from leaking all over the place. It's going to be a mud pit. Maybe the grass is terrible. It's like, there's going to be things that make the rest of us not want to stay there. So especially for people traveling through, because I mean, and talk to us maybe on that front while we're on that kind of page, is like, what is the most lucrative or what is the highest profit tenant? I'm going to use the word tenant in an RV park.
Great question. And so we are huge fans of the seasonal RV model, and we're focused in the Northeast of the US. So we're forced to do that by our cold winters. So, and it's funny, we talk to investors all over the country, and people have mixed reactions when we tell them that we focus on seasonal properties that are only open for 6 months. And some people that are from Florida or Texas or Southern California say, well, that sounds like it kind of stinks because you only have 6 months of revenue. I'd rather invest in a property that has 12 months of revenue. But there are several dynamics at play that make us really love that seasonal model. And the first is that typically these properties are at 90 to 100% full season renters. So they rent for the whole 6 months. They pay somewhere between like $2,000 and $5,000 a season, depending on the quality of the park. They pay their own utilities. They landscape their own site. And so, it's a very hands-off, almost kind of like a triple net feel to it. Granted, it's not triple net, but it's just, they don't want to be bothered a lot of times. They just kind of have their little vacation home, and they build decks around their campers, and they really get settled in. And, you know, we have several campers that are approaching a decade, some over 14, 16 years that have been there. So it's a very sticky model, so to speak, with the renters.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, that runs contrary. I do not personally own an RV park myself. I'm a passive investor in RV parks, but you know, that runs counter to what my understanding would have been as your highest. I would have thought, your most profitable tenant. I would have thought that maybe the transient person that comes in and spends $80 a night, you know, if you can keep those people flying through there, that your revenues would be higher. And you're saying no, just from maintenance and sticky revenue situation, it's much better to have a seasonal renter for an entire season, and then you're done messing with it.
Yeah, I mean, so the gross revenue will certainly be higher if you have a transient site that's well occupied, but you're paying all the utilities, your manager, whether it's yourself or you hire a manager, they're going to be a lot busier managing that. So it's kind of like brings in the 80-20 rule, where you want, and our vision is to own lots and lots of these properties. So if we owned lots and lots of transient RV parks, that would be lots of headaches. Yeah, you might be leaving some money on the table, so to speak, in terms of gross revenue. But the way we see it, you end up with a higher NOI with these properties on the seasonal front.
Right. And it sounds like it end up, you're not just, maybe not even just for the higher NOI, but also just a more predictable NOI.
Exactly. Yeah. Right?
Which bodes well, both when you're speaking to investors and also just, you know, for the planning phase of the business to say, okay, we know what this, you know, is going to do. So that's really intriguing. Talk to us about the camping side of it, because I know that the at least the one that you own now is, you said it's an RV park with a campground, or how did you put it, a campground with an RV park, or what's that look like, and kind of get?
Yeah, you know, I'd say this one leans more campground and RV park as opposed to RV park and campground. It's 48 RV sites. Right now it's only really 50% occupied on the RV side with all seasonals. So our goal is to lease up that 50% with more seasonals. But we have 23 tent sites, and we have a beautiful site in the Catskill Mountains situated on the Willowemaw Creek, which is famous for trout fishing. It's actually the area that's credited with the birthplace of American fly fishing. So we get a nice premium for these tent sites, and it's kind of amazing. They're primitive for the most part. Some of them just have water at the site. And for holiday weekends with large groups, sometimes people are, you know, with the extra fees, are paying almost $100 a night just for a tent site.
Wow.
So it's pretty compelling. And that'll always be part of this property, but it'll be a nice complement to lease up those 48 seasonal sites, because that's, you know, the more predictable revenue, much less active involvement for the manager, for myself for now. And on the tent side, that's where it's busy weekends, check-ins, check-outs, people coming into the store to buy things, which is great because that's revenue, but it's also, you know, active operating business type work as opposed to, you know, a more passive real estate investment.
Right, right. Yeah, run us through that on the operations side. I mean, is this something where you hire your own employees and you bring in your own staff, or is there a management company that you could bring in to operate this? What's that kind of model look like?
You have several options. For this property, we decided we were going to hire a manager to live on site. And with the labor troubles, you know, we had to go through a couple candidates. We thought we had some candidates locked up, and they backed out even before we closed. So we were super proactive about it, trying to make that hire before we even closed on the property, which actually ended up working out in our favor, because we now have a manager starting in a couple weeks who is a gentleman who's a highly talented carpenter and contractor, and he's an avid camper as well. So he's looking to kind of move towards his maybe retirement years and settle down. So, you know, this is something that he has a personal interest in, but he's also going to be essentially our general contractor, and he's going to build all types of new buildings for us and renovate the existing facilities. So it's a great match that we'll get a lot of efficiencies from.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot in the RV campgrounds, you know, where you find someone that is retirement age, or I've even seen husband and wife duos, you know, where they're out there saying, hey, you know, this is seasonal. We work 6 months, we take 6 months off. You know, we get to go stay somewhere fun and work a little bit. It is an interesting model in that, you know, I've not seen a lot of these where it's like, okay, here's your staff of seven people that run this, depending on the size of it, of course, but that run this facility. So that's very intriguing. And I like the idea that you have someone that lives on site, right? Because
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. That just relieves a lot of stress. I've seen that out of, in a lot of other playbooks as well. So that's really, really cool. Matt, I love what you're doing on these properties. You know, one last question for you on this financing on these. What's that been like? I know you said you're looking at, you know, 10 plus on the cap rate on the buy side. You know, what's it like to get these properties financed? Are you syndicating them? You know, does it even require that? Kind of give us the behind the curtains on that if you can.
Absolutely. So we always, on the debt side, we first look for seller financing. And that's because these are more difficult properties to finance on the debt side. And I think that's just a function of lenders not having wrapped their heads around the business model, because it's, for us, it's a phenomenal investment model. So to me, you know, when I think about it, any bank, it should be a no-brainer for them, but I just don't think they're there yet. Similar with mobile home parks, some lenders just haven't wrapped their heads around it. So I see that changing, because there's definitely a big migration of private equity dollars moving over into the space. We read articles all the time, even just in upstate New York, of private equity companies from all over the country scooping up these properties. And so on the equity side, yes, we syndicated the equity for this, and that's our traditional model. So first, we'll look for seller financing and syndicated equity. We are open to bank financing. We're working on one acquisition right now that we're working through bank financing just because the seller was not open to seller financing. But I'd say it's an asset class where your more sophisticated owners understand that a bank might not be ready and willing to finance their property. And I think a lot of times that's a function of the books that they have on hand. And that was the case in this property. So we had to reconstruct a lot of the books through receipts and purchase orders for goods. And, you know, they just didn't have really good books. So if we sent it out to any bank, that was going to be the main hurdle. But we felt comfortable enough through our own due diligence process to kind of reconstruct those operating statements.
Right. Yeah, that is an interesting place to be. But I guess if you are the one soliciting them to buy, then maybe they don't have the stuff in order that you would normally see from a sophisticated seller. So somebody's prepared to say, yeah, you're going to say, all right, you know, and maybe you get a discount because you're there reconstructing their books for them, saying, okay, right, look, guys, like, I'm going to help you figure out what we can pay. But at the same time, this maybe should have been a little cleaner in the, you know, on the front end. So,
right.
That's intriguing. Course, yeah. Matt, before we go, or before we jump into the final four questions here, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners as you guys have learned to scale and grow here in the RV and campground space?
You know, I'd say most of any advice I could provide on scaling probably comes actually from my software experience that we didn't touch on. But after I exited the commercial mortgage space as a financial analyst, I spent a few years working in software in real estate finance and private equity for a company that provides a back office solution for syndicators and investment managers. And that's really where I kind of saw the light of, even for these large institutional firms, my takeaway was keep it simple. Because I think real estate is a prime example of an antiquated industry where people build their Excel models and they don't really have an eye for scaling or, you know, an eye for making things repeatable. So they just do whatever's easiest in the moment to get to where they want to go.
Right.
And, you know, so that's in the back of my mind with everything that I do is let's build this process once rather than building it over and over again for every single different circumstance or anomaly that comes up with individual deals. And it definitely affects the way you do business and the decisions you make. But I think that's important because, yeah, it all comes back to risk as well. When you buy a 2-unit building or a 1-unit single family rental, you have binary vacancy risk. So if I've learned anything in acquiring almost $4 million in investment properties is do bigger deals because they're actually lower risk. So that's been my primary takeaway in my years in the industry.
Man, I love it. I love it. Matt, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Final four questions are this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
I'd say I'd find an operator like yourself, Sam, and invest passively to get a taste for, you know, what the quarterly reporting looks like, what the metrics I should be looking at, getting access to, you know, a highly skilled and experienced operator is really priceless. You know, the gravy in that situation is that if you do select the right operator, you're going to get some nice returns. But if you have an eye for doing it yourself, there's nothing better you can do than getting access to another experienced operator.
Right, right. Well said. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
One that's top of mind for me that I made myself was relying on the bank to check if a property's in a flood zone, because they only do that like 3 or 4 days before closing.
Right.
So it wasn't super impactful, but it was kind of a slap in the face that, like, I'm never going to let that one happen again, because it shifted the numbers a bit, but then we found some other areas to trim the fat, so to speak, so that the overall financials weren't affected too much. But that was a big one.
That is a big one. And lucky you finding it prior to close. So I've been the proud owner of property in a flood zone that no one knew about. So that,
wow.
Yeah, right. But those are things you have to work through. So regardless, question number three, when it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
You know, I think we lead with the apartments. We pride ourselves on being a responsive landlord and providing good, clean, safe, affordable housing. And that's a function of the market that we're in, that a lot of the buildings we buy on the apartment side are $700 to $800 in rent. So it's really workforce housing. And being a student of the market, I mean, it's just so obvious that that's where our country and I think it's mainly the U.S., but the world at large just lacks good, clean, safe, affordable housing. So that's what we try and lead with. And then on the campground and RV park side, it's more recreational. So it's less of a, you know, a human need, but just the same, you know, we're supplying an escape for people. So just providing good customer service and treating people the way they want to be treated and just providing that escape for people is rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's fantastic. Matt, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
You can go to our website, newscotlandcapital.com, and you'll find all of our companies and my personal contact information. You can also email me at matt@newscotlandcapital.com.
Matt, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Sam. Have a great one.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.